lesson is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome all of you to our first oral argument in December. But we're especially delighted to welcome some high school students who are with us today. Would the Stockbridge High School students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Would the Mount Horeb High School students please stand? Thank you. We're delighted you came. You may be seated. The students are with us with a program that is sponsored by the State Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. This is a program which invites high school students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the students come. They have been given copies of your brief, and they may have engaged in some activities relating to this case. After the second oral argument today, the students will meet with a justice, me today, and we will discuss the procedures of the court, not any of the substantive issues involved in the cases. And everyone is invited to join us at this noon session. You need not be one of the high school students. Let me introduce to you all the members of the court. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. The only other thing I have to say as a preliminary matter is if anyone would like a summary of this case, you can raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary. All right. If any of you have a summary and don't want it, you can give it to the marshal. All right. I now call our first case. 03AP2840, Barbara A. Mayers versus Bayer AG. Arguing on behalf of Bayer is Fred H. Bartlett, Jr. You're going to be introduced by Wisconsin Attorney Jerry Gonzalez. That's 25 minutes. Then 25 minutes will be given to hearing Owen Thomas Armstrong representing the plaintiff appellant. And then 5 minutes has been ceded to Eric Wilson, representing the amicus curiae state of Wisconsin, and then a rebuttal, Mr. Bartlett. Right? Okay. Mr. Bartlett, but first I'll recognize Attorney Gonzalez.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, may it please the court, counsel. I'm Jerry Gonzalez with the firm of Gonzalez, Sajo, and Harlan from Milwaukee. We are here on behalf of the defendant, respondents, petitioners. Today, Attorney Frederick Bartlett from the law firm of Bartlett & Beck from Denver, Colorado, will be arguing on behalf of the defendant, respondent, petitioners.
Mr. Bartlett. I'm assuming that you're a lawyer in good standing, licensed in Colorado?
Yes.
You are now admitted pro hoc vici for purposes of arguing the case this morning.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin, I've been a member of the bar for 46 years, and this is my first opportunity to appear in your court, and I deeply appreciate it, and I won't forget it.
We'll see to that, counsel.
Having gotten things off on the right foot. I was reminded, Chief Justice, that my mom was a high school teacher, and when she took kids to see men and women doing their jobs back then, mainly men, she said they all then wanted to be the thing they'd seen. And I warned one of the teachers, I said, tell them not to be a lawyer. The issue here, just to get right at it, is what is the meaning of the phrase substantial effects in this court's Olstead decision? This court led up to that in Olstead by saying that Wisconsin's Little Sherman Act may reach interstate commerce under some circumstances, clearly not all circumstances. And then the court said that a civil plaintiff filing under the Wisconsin Little Sherman Act has to allege that the conduct complained of substantially affects the people of Wisconsin.
Before you go further, does the conduct have to be illegal conduct?
That's a question I hadn't thought of, frankly, Justice Rogensack. I would say this, that the Zakuli case has a two-pronged test, and it appears at first that it's two prongs, but maybe it really isn't two prongs, because the court said, the lower court, the Court of Appeals, in the September 26th Sulkowski decision said, you need specific effects on Wisconsin commerce, not merely an effect that's nationwide, and that it has to be, for example, more than a general nationwide effect on price. And, of course, this court in Olstead said, in the point two of this court's test, that you can have, that the Little Sherman Act of Wisconsin can reach conduct that occurs entirely outside of the state of Wisconsin. And the question is, where do we draw that line? One would imagine, I think it would be possible, that conduct occurring involving Wisconsin, which was not illegal, could provide a nexus. For example, one of my smart young people said, what if there was a conspiracy outside Wisconsin, let's say in Chicago, to control the prices on Green Bay Packers T-shirts and things like that, which would have a more dramatic effect probably in Wisconsin than somewhere else.
But isn't the conduct to control price illegal conduct, or is that legal conduct?
Of course.
All right. Well, that my question to you is, you're focusing on the substantial effect, and what I'm saying to you is, does the conduct that drives that effect have to be illegal conduct, or can you still fall within Olstead if the conduct itself is lawful?
Well, I would say that the conduct that basically drives the liability has to be wrongdoing. It has to be a conspiracy taking place somewhere. But that doesn't mean that there can't be acts within the state which, although are not illegal, might provide a peculiar nexus between Wisconsin and the wrongdoing acts outside the state. I think that's possible.
But in other words, well, let me just follow up on Justice Rogensack. Here, your client, let's put it this way, there was a patent. It expired in 2004. Very quickly, Barr, don't want to get Barr and Bayer mixed up, but Barr was going to manufacture a generic drug, same as Cipro. And they entered into a settlement. Now, had there been no settlement, had there been nothing, you still had basically what we call, is it wrong to call it a monopoly? In other words, you had the patent. You were the only people that could produce Cipro.
There was a legal monopoly.
So if you had raised prices and we had the same effect, only you didn't have the settlement agreement, Barr didn't exist, there wouldn't be any, would there be an action under 133 if you had just raised prices?
The Wisconsin cases, in terms of how federal cases affect Wisconsin, say different things. They say maybe it would be good to observe what federal cases say. Sometimes they come close to saying that they're bound because there's a paucity of Wisconsin law. But the federal law is this, as Judge Traeger ruled in this very case. If I have a patent and I can do any act that's within the inherent exclusionary effect of the patent. If I have a patent, I have the right to exclude competition. If it's a valid patent, I have the right to exclude competition. That means that I can make a deal with anybody that they won't challenge the patent in return for an amount of money, because what I have done in removing that competitor from the marketplace is what I had a right to do anyway under the valid patent. And, of course, this patent, I thought the law professor's briefs added quite a bit, amicus brief added quite a bit to this case, because they said you have to watch out for these patents because if a weak patent, and the Lord knows there are a lot of weak patents out there, if a weak patent can be used to get control of a market, because every time somebody challenges your weak patent, you buy them off, that wouldn't be a good thing. So the law professor's brief really drove home the core issue that we're dealing with here.
However, I'd like to interrupt you because you're talking about Judge Traeger's decision, and I want to touch on that a little bit. Are you taking the position that there's preemption here by federal law?
No, sir.
All right. And you're not arguing that the same kind of argument that was presented to him in regard to the scope of the patent, as I understand it. In other words, you're really zeroing in on Wisconsin law and on the substantially affects test and whether or not that is or is not satisfied. Is that correct?
Yes, I am, and I'm responding to the amicus brief, and the amicus brief was worried, as I would be if I were on this court, about weak patents. This patent has been held valid 5 different times, twice by the Federal Patent Office and by 6 different federal judges, 3 federal trial judges, and it was appealed to the Federal Circuit. So we know here we have an unusual situation in that we have a valid patent. In terms of the substantiality test, as I looked at this case, I wondered if this was an appropriate vehicle, with all due deference, because there is really a balancing question here. When we're looking at the substantiality of the effect on the citizens of Wisconsin of this overall litigation and these issues, we have an interesting situation because the other federal litigation has proceeded far down the road. 34 or 35 different law firms have been pursuing us in this case, with as many as 50 or 60 lawyers appearing on the papers. The case has been briefed, ventilated, argued, and decided. And given the fact that Wisconsin courts look with some deference, not total, of course, with some deference to federal antitrust decisions, it makes one wonder. This court knows more than we do about the problems of court delay in Milwaukee, how long it takes to get to court for an ordinary person who's had an injury. The courts are very crowded. Is it in the interest of commerce in Wisconsin and the citizens of Wisconsin to take a case involving organic chemistry, very complicated patent office practice, the interrelationship of the antitrust laws and the patent laws, scores of depositions over 6 years all over the country, and impose that on a trial judge, maybe not even having a clerk because of budget constraints, and certainly not having a clerk that's familiar with organic chemistry?
Counselor, I want to go back to Justice Crook's question to you because I'm a little bit confused by your answer. He asked you if you were arguing there was federal preemption here, and you said no, but when you and I talked about Bayer's patent and when you responded to Justice Wilcox, those answers are confusing to me. And I guess my question to you is this. You tell us that Bayer has a strong patent. If Bayer's patent is valid, are you maintaining then that there could be no claim under Wisconsin antitrust law? Because to me that's preemption.
Yes.
So I'm not understanding your answer,
well,
to Justice Crooks.
What I'm claiming is this, Justice Rogan-Sack. The It's not a question of preemption. It's a question of Wisconsin courts looking to federal judges who have decided federal antitrust issues, because the language of the Wisconsin Little Sherman Act is exactly the same as the Federal Sherman Act.
Now, that's not my question. I'm not doing a good job. I'm sorry.
I'm not the one that's
My question is this. Don't worry about the federal judges. Presume the patent of Bayer's is valid. Okay, that's a federal award, that patent.
Okay. Correct.
If that patent is valid, are you arguing then that there could be no claim under Wisconsin Little Sherman Act?
Yes, I am, as a matter of antitrust law, pure antitrust law.
Where is that in your brief?
Well, what I said in the brief, Chief Justice, is this. I would agree that a Wisconsin trial judge could look at the question as a matter of original question under Wisconsin antitrust law. I would agree with that. But I would say that the Wisconsin cases say that that Wisconsin trial judge would look to what the federal judges say on cases like this. They wouldn't be bound, but that's where they look.
Counsel, as I understand the question, okay, question is, if you don't have a contract, if you don't have a combination in the form of the trust, and you don't have a conspiracy in restraint of trade or commerce, can you fall under 133.03? The answer has to be no. Right? I mean, the statute's quite
right.
Clear. All right. As I read your brief, that isn't your argument. You're not arguing that there has been no allegation. And for purposes of your motion, we have to accept the allegations as true.
Yes.
You're not arguing that there has been no contract, that there's been no combination in the form of a trust. There's no conspiracy in restraint of trade or commerce. You're arguing that even accepting these as true doesn't fall within the Wisconsin Act because there haven't been specific allegations of substantial and particularized effects upon Wisconsin consumers, et cetera.
That's correct.
Okay. So it seems to me you're accepting the Wisconsin standard under the statute, which you have to do, right, unless you want us to overrule any case, which you can ask us to do. You have to accept that. And now the question is, are you coming in within it? I mean, that's how I see the case.
And
if I'm wrong, you're free to tell me.
That is exactly our argument. And in a nutshell, what we're saying here is that here are the only complaint allegations that relate to Wisconsin. There are 19 different allegations in the complaint, national conspiracy, national conspiracy, national conspiracy, national conspiracy. Then there's two sentences. One sentence in paragraph 19 says, Cipro purchasers number in the millions nationally, and there are, at a minimum, thousands of Cipro purchasers in Wisconsin. That's the first connection with Wisconsin. And then with regard to these so-called thousands of Cipro purchasers, paragraph 84 says, they indirectly purchased Cipro from Bayer. It doesn't say who they bought from. It doesn't say where the people who they bought from bought it. It doesn't say how many intermediaries they are. It doesn't say whether they bought from people, whether there were three or four levels in the distribution chain. The way we read Olstad, this court said substantial has to have a meaning. And the meaning is more than any. And then the court said, and it's important that we give weight to the word substantial. Otherwise, we could have problems with the validity of the Wisconsin Section 133, and we could create a Lilliputian harassment, a multiplication of litigation, all over the United States. It's interesting. This court's website, which I read yesterday out of curiosity, characterized the case this way, and I think it's a very good way to characterize it. It said, does substantial effects mean that any antitrust violation anywhere in the United States counts as a violation of Wisconsin law simply because there's an allegation that some of defendants' products ultimately made their way to Wisconsin? I thought that was an interesting way to capture in a better
What's
way.
What's your answer?
My
What's
answer
your
is
answer?
This. That cannot be the law. In the first place, these issues come up all the time, and it's interesting that plaintiffs haven't cited a single case in any other state that goes that far. If that were the law, every one of these national conspiracies that we have that where it has exactly the same effect in every state in the union could be rebrought in every state of the union. no case has gone that far. And to us, it raises the considerations that this court was concerned about in Olmstead.
Go ahead.
Are there other cases in state court that are similar to this one?
You mean in our litigation?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
How many?
New York, Kansas, Tennessee, Florida, and California.
Are the complaints essentially the same? Other than citing statutes?
Well, the Little Sherman Acts changed some, and as one would expect, the California law is always a little more to it. There have been different results in different states.
What does a little more to it mean?
As one would expect.
Let's say it's more fully developed, or maybe some would say less fully developed, but there's more law.
It's different.
It's different.
All right.
Yes, Chief Justice.
That's okay.
So there are these five other cases.
So is the climate. Go ahead.
Could I ask a question, or a procedural question that I don't know the answer to? This is a motion to dismiss.
Sir.
And in the complaint, it says that the patent is invalid. Do we have to accept that as true in this posture?
I think so. The issue isn't whether there's, you know, we're not arguing liability here, of course.
You're being recorded. That's why you're being signaled to stand up.
We're not arguing liability. We're considering whether, assuming that, Wisconsin law has the reach that it's claimed that it has in this case. That's the issue.
Now, I'm sorry. In the complaint, it says that the patent is invalid. I have the Second Amendment complaint. Maybe you could point that out to me.
I accept what the court said. I did not recall that, but
I don't
the court's recollection is probably better than mine.
I don't recall that either. It has some concern for me because, as we all know, you cannot litigate a patent claim in a state court. It must be done in a federal court. So if that's an allegation in the complaint, I have concerns that I don't think anybody briefed, at least
I'm not sure it's quite a direct statement, but I mean, I think implicit in the complaint is that the patent is invalid. If the patent was perfectly valid, I think that goes to the questions asked by other members of the court of what ability the state of Wisconsin would have to curtail an absolutely valid patent.
We do know the patent is valid. As a matter of fact, it's been held valid five times. So we know as a fact that the patent is valid. And I would have to say that I've looked into this, and there are some extremely arcane situations where in some state courts, believe it or not, state judges have considered the validity of federal patents, their contract and licensing issues. They don't go to the question of enforcement of the patent, but they don't apply here. Let's just say that. So we know the patent is valid, and we know if the patent's valid, the settlement is lawful. The only question here is, do we have to litigate that entire issue all over again in Wisconsin when it's been litigated to the...
You cannot litigate it before us. There is a federal statute which precludes us from taking up that issue. We have no jurisdiction to decide if this patent is valid or invalid. That's under federal law. I mean, I can quote you the section of it, but I mean, if that's an issue here, no one's briefed it for us, but I am certain that I have no authority to decide if the patent is valid or invalid.
That's why I wondered whether this case was the most suitable vehicle to consider the meaning of substantial effects in Olmstead, because it's really a sport case in many ways. It involves issues that normally are never considered by state courts.
Well, that's true.
Getting to the point of substantial effects, I know you've tried to get at that a couple of times. I know the Olmstead decision relied in part on Allied Chemical. And doesn't the Allied Chemical decision, at least in part, give a definition of substantial effects? And I'm looking on at the case, I believe, at page 295. The public interest and welfare of the people of Wisconsin are substantially affected if prices of a product are fixed or supplies thereof are restricted as the result of an illegal combination or conspiracy?
Well, it's interesting that that is what the Allied Court says at the very end. But then the Allied Court says something different. The Allied Court says that there are two allegations here in the complaint. One is an allegation of an overall conspiracy that affects prices in Wisconsin. And then number two is an allegation of some acts by the conspirators taking place in Wisconsin. It doesn't ever say what those acts are. It's a 1960 case, and nobody knows what those acts are. And then at the very end, Justice Butler, as the court makes that broad pronouncement, the court says, of course, they have to prove what's alleged in the complaint. So I read myself, Allied, as saying you need both of those, and the broad general statement, I would say, is to a certain extent not necessary to the decision. I think my time is up.
You get 5 minutes.
You have five more minutes of this.
Can't get away that easy.
It's interesting. Justice Prosser, you asked me the question, don't we have to assume whatever the complaint says? It's interesting that in the Zukowski case, the tire chemical case, which this court is aware of, the Court of Appeals there assumed that the chemical conspiracy had, in fact, raised the prices of tires within the state of Wisconsin. But they said, assuming that, because there were no specific effects on Wisconsin commerce that were different from the general nationwide effects on prices of tires in all states, Section 133 did not reach that chemical price-fixing conspiracy, even assuming that people within the state had paid more for their tires as a result. Now, that case was decided literally 2 months ago. It's interesting how all these cases have come together at this time.
Mr. Bartlett, didn't that Court of Appeals decision, however, distinguish this case from that case and say that this case was a very different one?
It said in footnote 9, that was a case where the chemical manufacturers conspired on prices. They sold the chemicals to the tire makers sold them to the truck makers, and the truck makers sold them. And footnote 9 is a little odd because it's not tied at all to the two-part test. It's sort of in a way, it's sort of a standing argument. But what I would say is this, that I would take that footnote 9 and I would look at the allegations of the complaint here and say the allegations of the complaint here do not rise to any higher level. Because, as I read earlier, they simply say there were millions of Cipro purchasers nationally and thousands in Wisconsin, and the people in Wisconsin indirectly purchased Cipro from Bayer. Well, in the footnote 9, they at least spun out the thread of how the purchasing, the events went from the price fixing of the chemicals through to the Bayer. The complaint here doesn't even spin out that thread. It simply says there's thousands of purchasers here, and they indirectly purchase, not how, where, how, or when. And it would be hard to imagine a slighter allegation of impact on Wisconsin than the allegations in the complaint. Those allegations are really, I've said, this court says substantial means something. We need this higher level, this heightened level, in order to validate the statute and for other good reasons. The allegations that are in the complaint here are more like any impact rather than a heightened substantial impact. So I have no problem with footnote 9 when you look at the actual allegations of the complaint in this case. I think it is more of a standing issue, but we're willing to confront it, as I have.
Mr. Bartlett, I've got a fact question. I'm not sure if this is important or not, but it's something that concerns me, so I'll ask you. I haven't had a chance to digest Judge Schrager's decision from the New York case, but I do understand that there was a settlement agreement, and I understand that there was a consent judgment. The settlement agreement included the payment, the $398 payment. The consent judgment does not. Do we know, based on this decision, whether the settlement agreement was also presented to the judge prior to the judge signing the consent judgment?
It was not.
Thank you.
If there are no more questions, I appreciate very much the opportunity to appear here.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Armstrong, representing Barbara Myers. Mr. Armstrong.
Well, Your Honor, I first want to address the obvious concern of the court about the issue of patent validity. I think, as the Chief Justice pointed out, this is an issue that has not been briefed. It is not the issue that was noticed by the court. But to answer Justice Roggenzak's question, there is no allegation of patent invalidity in the complaint. And the reference to the agreement and the antitrust violation in the complaint, at least one of them, appears at paragraph 76. While Barr and Bear purported to settle the litigation, the agreement was nothing more than a privately negotiated restraint of trade between horizontal competitors. The purpose of the agreement was to perpetuate, solidify, and extend Bayer's monopoly power in the relevant market. We do not then have an allegation of patent invalidity.
Well, counsel, if that's the case, look, you had Cipro was sold by Bayer before the litigation, and Cipro was sold by Bayer after the litigation. You do allege, maybe I'm wrong, but you certainly allege that there was a, quote, conspiracy, that something was illegal. But as far as the producer, as far as the consumer, one person was producing and the consumers bought. You're saying, well, the intermediate act where there was this litigation, which opposing counsel indicated has been going on, went on in many federal courts, what the damage, you say, is a price increase.
That's
correct.
To
say the price increase, you mean that they would not have increased the price if they hadn't had the litigation?
Well, this is an issue, I think, that really is an affirmative defense to be asserted by the defendant in this case.
What's the damage, the price increase?
Well, certainly that's a component of the damage. But I think this is what is alleged here is it's a per se violation. And I really am not and was not prepared to discuss at length antitrust law. But, for example, the Sixth Circuit has held that this is an issue of a per se violation. And damages under the federal antitrust law, which is similar to Wisconsin's, may have as a component certainly the ability to raise prices via a monopoly. But I think for purposes of the motion that's before the court, this is a motion to dismiss, and we are accepting the allegations as pleeded. That they're being true.
In fact, we have liberal pleading, so...
Yes, we do. We have notice pleading here.
What does liberal pleading mean? You just have to plead something?
Well, I do believe we've pleaded illegal conduct, which has resulted in harm to Wisconsin consumers.
Counsel, what's the illegal conduct?
It's a restraint of trade. It is the agreement between Bayer and Barr.
Okay, so if it's the agreement between Bayer and Barr, don't you have to show that Barr would have had the right to compete with Bayer absent the agreement? Otherwise, why is the restraint illegal?
Well, some agreements, Your Honor, are per se invalid. And as I say, I'm not totally prepared to discuss the nuances of antitrust law here. And I don't believe that was the issue that the court recognized. It's not the issue that's been briefed. But it's my understanding that under antitrust law, that would not necessarily be a component of a damage claim, that we absolutely show that there's been an unlawful patent that had Barr proceeded without the settlement, that it would have been successful in defeating the patent. Rather, we have an agreement here between competitors to preclude, under which Barr unlawfully agreed not to pursue something that it had alleged it had a right to do. And it's that agreement that constitutes a violation of the antitrust law.
It only violates the antitrust law if the patent is invalid. Otherwise, Bayer's got the right to set the price wherever they want it.
Well, Your Honor, that may or may not be. I'm not prepared to tell you that you are incorrect in that point. I don't believe it's been briefed. It is asserted in the complaint that there was unlawful activity resulting in harm to plaintiffs.
So that's all you have to assert, that there was unlawful activity, and where does that take us? What in my just looking at this, it's troubling, I think, that you're making an assertion. We read the brief. We know that Bayer had a patent. If you have a patent, you have basically a state-given monopoly for a certain period of time. The generic drug company, Bayer, said, well, we're going to make your drug. So they have litigation, and then they arrive at a settlement. And I guess what that's the crux for me. How do you get?
Well, wholly apart from the issue of whether the patent was valid, I believe there is an issue under antitrust law as to whether parties in this situation can enter into an agreement where party A pays party B not to proceed. It's a reverse payment, not to pursue its lawful rights, with the result, quite foreseeable and intended, to damage consumers. Because obviously if generic products are introduced, there has to be a lowering of the price for Cipro, or they're going to suffer by way of the competitive product, the generic product.
But would Bayer have sold the Cipro had they prevailed on the counterclaim? In other words, Bayer, we've got two B's here, but B-A-R-R. What would they have sold?
They would have sold a generic drug.
And there's an assumption that would have been less.
That's been alleged, Your Honor, that it would have been substantially less, and I think that's borne out by statistics. Which, again, just to get to a point here, with respect to proving the substantial effect test, I think what opposing counsel is suggesting to this court is that a plaintiff be able to accumulate all of this knowledge and information sufficient to allow it to plead the particulars that are being demanded by Bayer in this case. I view this as very similar to an issue of personal jurisdiction.
Counselor, let me interrupt you again. I'm sorry, because I know you don't want to talk about this, and I sympathize with you because there isn't much in your briefs, but it's troublesome to me because the premise behind your claim is that Bayer would have sold this drug, the generic Cipro, at a lower price than Bayer. Then you tell me, well, you didn't allege the patent was invalid, and I agree with you. I don't think the amended complaint says that either. But if the patent is valid, you have to show me some way that Bayer would have had the ability to compete with Bayer, because they couldn't have marketed the drug you're telling us caused this harm if, in fact, the patent is valid. So I'm having difficulty seeing how you're asking us to decide this case.
Well, Your Honor, as I view your question, it really is an issue of causation and whether we have to plead in order to state a valid cause of action that the patent was invalid in order to establish that there was actual harm to Wisconsin consumers by having to pay higher prices.
You have to show that Bayer could have marketed this product in Wisconsin. You have to be able to allege that truthfully in your complaint, and we would accept your allegation as true. But you're really losing me, I'm sorry, on this argument, because I don't see how you can stand there and say they would have entered the market and sold this product and then turn around and say to me, but we've never alleged the patent is invalid. I'm really having trouble lining those two things up that I'm supposed to both accept as true.
Well, Your Honor, again, I think the issue, the assumption in your question is that under antitrust law, there is no viable antitrust claim, period, if the patent is valid. And that is a premise that I think I am taking issue with.
All right.
Let me follow that up, because you made a point, and this may help answer Justice Rogenczak's question. Based on your argument, we're looking at the Olstead test, we're looking at the Allied test, and you have to have an illegal combination or conspiracy, and I think you've made that argument. That's what you're alleging here.
That is absolutely true.
All right. Yes, sir. The consent judgment was placed before the trial court in New York. Had the settlement agreement, which included the payments, also been presented to the court and signed off by the trial court in that matter, would this be a different case? Could we reach your issue?
It very well might be, and I think you're raising the very point I'm trying to raise, Your Honor, perhaps more eloquently, and I believe that our position in this case is that the agreement itself is invalid. Putting aside the question of whether we have a valid patent or not, that type of activity is proscribed by the antitrust laws. And where we go from there, I think, needs to be developed as a matter of record. But that is, I'm just simply taking issue with the premise that a necessary component of our cause of action is to establish the invalidity of the patent. I do understand Justice Roggensack's concern that one would assume naturally in a typical tort action that in order to prove causation, one would have to show that had Barr not been bought off, it would have been successful in challenging the validity of the patent so that it could then manufacture its generic equivalent, which, of course, according to the allegations, would have been at a substantially lower price, thereby requiring Cipro to come down in price to compete, or at least giving the consumer the option to purchase the generic. So I think for purposes of what is before the court today, there is no issue other than that we have stated a viable claim unless we have to assert the invalidity of the patent in this complaint, which is something that was not briefed. It has not been argued by opposing counsel. In fact, opposing counsel didn't even know if there was an allegation in the complaint as to whether the patent was invalid.
Counsel.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Justice. Justice Prosser earlier asked a question, and in that question, as I understood it, he suggested that the Second Amended complaint inferred an invalid patent. I may have misunderstood, but that's what I heard. And I look at paragraph 57, and when I read paragraph 57, I got the same kind of inference. That is, it says that Barr asked the FDA for approval to peddle its generic drug, that the FDA gave Barr approval to peddle its generic drug, but then there came the stipulation and agreement, and paragraph 57, as I read it anyway, what says, following FDA approval, absent the stipulation, Barr would have been entitled under FDA regulations to introduce its generic version of Cipro on or about January 6, 1995. I guess I interpret that tantamount as to saying, you know, if it's a valid patent, how come someone else can sell it and had approval to sell it? So that's where I inferred it. I don't know if that's exactly what Justice Prosser was referring to, but that's what the way I saw the allegation in the complaint.
Well, I believe that is absolutely true. As you know, the procedure here is that you do get tentative approval to market. It's then the burden then is on the patent holder to commence an action against for patent infringement. And I think this paragraph is really the introduction to that process, that there is a tentative approval. But what happened here, the whole process was truncated by the settlement agreement, which really is the focal point of the cause of action. Is this settlement agreement?
Let me ask you on that. Under your theory, are there any cases where a patent holder who pays money, you mentioned the settlement, which results in here Bayer continued to sell the item, would not be subject to our statute 133? Are there some cases? Because that seems to be your point, that here they should have continued the litigation, whatever it was. One or the other would have had the patent. But because they settled it, that's what they did that allows you to come in.
Your Honor, I'm not aware that there are any cases dealing with this particular drug. I do believe that there are cases involving agreements of this nature, and I'm not sure whether they're decided under the same statutory scheme, but that in effect an agreement that buys off a competitor in order to prevent that competitor from competing at a lower price constitutes a per se violation of the antitrust law. I think the critical issue in this case, which is unaddressed in the briefs, and I think should be left for another day, and that is, what is the effect of those court decisions dealing with the validity of the patent? Not all of those are final. There's an appeal pending in the Second Circuit as we speak. So I think it's an overstatement when counsel says that, as a matter of fact, this is a valid patent. I take issue with that. I think that is still an issue that can be addressed.
It could be addressed. I'm sorry to interrupt any time, because anyone could bring litigation and say, but what he was saying, I think he said, well, we've been challenged in various courts, and for five times our patent has been upheld. So I assume in this day of litigation in these areas that the mere fact that you have a lawsuit and you have a settlement wouldn't automatically mean that you get to this point.
Not at all, Your Honor. That is absolutely correct. But I do believe that is an issue for another day. We are here on a motion to dismiss a complaint, and I think certainly
on particular grounds.
On particular grounds, that's quite correct. And these issues, I think, are all very substantial and need to be addressed. It's just an issue of whether they are to be addressed in this setting. And I think we are at a significant disadvantage in that regard, because that was not the issue that opposing counsel briefed, even though in their brief they noted that there was no allegation of patent invalidity. We do not see a word in that brief claiming that this complaint fails to state a cause of action because of that omission. And I think it would be inappropriate in this setting, unless there is absolutely no disputed issue of fact here, that we have to establish that as a matter of law, and that the court doesn't need briefing on that issue, or no court needs briefing on that issue, that no state court has jurisdiction over this case, because by necessity the validity of the patent must be determined by a state court.
Now, Counselor, you would agree with me that the validity of a patent must be determined by a federal court, correct?
Your Honor, I am not. I certainly trust your instinct in that regard. I can't say unequivocally.
My instinct comes from 25 U.S. Code 1338.
I did not look at that prior to coming here, Your Honor, and I don't profess to be an expert on that particular subject, but you could very well be right.
Well, you know, what troubles me is if we proceed down the road with this case and we say you can go forward on your claim, don't we get to that at some point? And if we have to get to determining whether the patent is valid or invalid, aren't we wasting our time to spend so much time on this case at this point?
I couldn't agree more, Your Honor. If this court, if the parties had been in a position to brief that issue, if that was the one of the grounds upon which the defendant in this case moved to dismiss this action.
Now, you missed my point. I understand exactly what you're saying. I have tremendous sympathy with your position. I've stood there lots of times, and it's very hard when someone presses you on something that was not briefed. So you have all my sympathies. My concern is that if I buy your argument and I say, yes, you've stated a claim sufficient, I have to accept everything in the complaint as true, which we will do under our standards of review on a motion to dismiss, and you go forward, doesn't this lawsuit require us eventually to determine whether the patent is valid or invalid?
My answer to that is no, Your Honor, although I can't cite chapter and verse to you.
Okay.
I think if I made that admission, I can understand that this case could be dismissed and probably should be dismissed, because, as Your Honor points out, there's no point in going any further.
Right.
But I cannot state with any confidence to you that, yes, indeed, we have to establish the invalidity of the patent in order to have a cause of action.
All right. Thank you. That's a good answer.
It may be, that the defendant should have moved to dismiss. It may be that the defendant should have moved to dismiss that this is a federal action patent and not state. It may be that the defendant should have moved to dismiss on the grounds that your complaint does not state a cause of action because there's no illegal agreement that there's no illegal. I mean, maybe. That isn't what we hear about. And it may be that we're here on the wrong issues. But I would like if we could just spend 10 minutes of your time discussing 13301 as if you did have a good claim, and whether or not that claim can be made in Wisconsin because you have shown substantial effect. Maybe that when the court meets in conference, you can hear what's going to happen, right? Okay. But just for the just because I wasted a lot of time reading your briefs on this particular issue, I'd like to hear a discussion. Okay?
Certainly, Your Honor.
All right.
I believe the briefs highlight two particular issues for the court. One of them, I would submit, has already been resolved by this court in Microsoft. This is the first issue I would characterize as a Microsoft redo, and that is that there has to be some disproportionate harm to Wisconsin consumers in order to satisfy the substantial effects test. That is precisely the argument that Microsoft made before this court, that if the predominant effect, the predominant harm is interstate in nature, the Wisconsin antitrust statute, the Little Sherman Act, does not reach that harm. The court rejected that argument then. It should reject it here. And in fact, several of the cases that counsel relies upon for its proposition, that being Emergency One and Freeman, both of those courts rejected the proposition that there has to be disproportionate harm to the consumer in a given state in order to satisfy the substantial effects test. Both of them, and I think it's important to note that both Emergency One and Freeman involved non-resident plaintiffs. And one of the Chamber of Horrors arguments that's raised, that is raised by opposing counsel in this case is that we are going to become a magnet for litigation all over this country because every non-resident is going to assert a claim in Wisconsin. I would submit, Your Honors, that non-residents are in a different position. In fact, the Freeman Court held that the non-resident plaintiff in that case, who was the only person affected, there was no allegation of any harm to any Tennessee resident in that case. This was a New York plaintiff who purchased a product. Part of the conspiracy was alleged to have taken place in Tennessee. The Freeman Court held that's not enough. You also have to show substantial impact on Tennessee commerce, on the citizens of Tennessee, which you did not show. The same thing is true in Emergency One. There was no allegation of any harm extending beyond an individual plaintiff in that case. Again, the individual plaintiff in that case, a non-resident of Wisconsin. I will say that the court, in its last paragraph in Microsoft, seemed to intimate that if there is antitrust conduct occurring in Wisconsin, anybody could then assert a claim under the Wisconsin Little Sherman Act. And I don't think we have to reach that issue here because obviously the plaintiffs in this case are Wisconsin residents. But perhaps in order to address the Chamber of Horrors argument that everybody's going to be suing in Wisconsin, there should be additional requirements that a non-resident must meet in order to bring a Wisconsin Little Sherman Act claim. Perhaps a non-resident must establish that there is some conduct in Wisconsin that violates the Little Sherman Act, and also establish that there is a substantial impact on Wisconsin consumers.
Is there anything about the impact of this alleged illegal combination that is greater in Wisconsin or different in Wisconsin than any other state?
No, Your Honor, there is not. And I would submit that there need not be, and I can't imagine why the Wisconsin legislature, being concerned with harm to Wisconsin consumers, would have enacted in 1980 the modification to the Little Sherman Act with the concern that Wisconsin citizens be harmed in a greater sense than citizens of California, Arkansas, or New Mexico. The issue, I believe, that this court raised in Microsoft is whether there is a substantial impact on the citizens of Wisconsin as a result of the unlawful conduct. How that determination is affected by whether there is a similar impact on citizens in other states is simply beyond me. I do not understand that at all. Certainly the court in Freeman, for what it's worth, and the court in Emergency One rejected the proposition that there has to be disproportionate harm. Really, that's simply another way of saying that the Little Sherman Act is inapplicable where the predominant effect is on interstate commerce, because that is simply another way of saying the predominant effect occurs outside the state of Wisconsin. Well, there are 49 other states. Certainly, the citizens in those states may be equally harmed by unlawful conduct, but I don't believe the Wisconsin legislature intended to confine the scope of the Antitrust Act to situations where Wisconsin consumers are injured more than other consumers. In fact, I think it would render the indirect purchaser provision in the Little Sherman Act essentially useless, because I think, as the Court noted in several cases, and the Seventh Circuit has noted, and I believe in one of the footnotes in Microsoft, this Court noted that in today's world, these types of conspiracies are nationwide and international. It would be a most unusual case, and as counsel gave you one concerning Green Bay Packers sweatshirts, I suspect that that is never going to arise. And I think if the scope of the statute was limited to cases where harm to Wisconsin consumers exceeded the harm to consumers in other states, I think essentially that statute would become useless. I don't believe there would be virtually any case where there's going to be harm that's directed in particular at Wisconsin consumers, either intentionally or as an effect of a conspiracy.
Well, the picture you're painting, as I see it, is that there can be antitrust enforcement by the United States Department of Justice, perhaps by federal litigants, attorney general in every state, and perhaps in the District of Columbia as well, and all the private plaintiffs. It seems as though what you're contemplating is antitrust enforcement. There would be no rhyme or reason to it.
Well, Your Honor, there wouldn't be federal action here because, obviously, under Illinois BRIC, there is no federal antitrust violation in a situation such as exists in this case where we have indirect purchasers. Illinois BRIC precludes any federal cause of action. So what we are left with are those states that have enacted indirect purchaser statutes. And frankly, I think a state is perfectly free to limit application of its statute to its own residents. I mean, after all, that is what the Wisconsin legislature was concerned about when it modified or changed the law in 1980. The court was concerned with Wisconsin consumers, with Wisconsin businesses. I don't see any need at all to allow non-residents to take advantage of that law. So I don't, if states want to enact their own laws to protect their own residents, that's fine. But I don't see the great overlap that your counsel, that Your Honor anticipates here. First of all, there is no federal action in this regard. And the fact that various states may enact laws similar to Wisconsin's, I don't think presents any problem whatsoever, except where there is overlap. And I'm not, in this case, certainly, we are not non-resident plaintiffs. All of our plaintiffs are residents of Wisconsin. So it may be that this court, in its ability to interpret and apply the Act, may choose to limit it or require more from non-residents than it would from residents, because I don't believe the legislature was really intending, when it modified the law in 1980, to extend the law to non-residents. And that is, again, the situation that was involved in both Freeman and Emergency One. I do believe the Court of Appeals recent decision in Crompton may have reached the right result, but again, for the wrong reason. I think, as the in the Attorney General's brief notes, there is an issue of antitrust standing. And in that case, we have a component, a conspiracy among manufacturers of components. That's not an end product that's put through the chain of distribution and eventually purchased by a Wisconsin consumer. So I would distinguish that case on antitrust standing grounds, as I think counsel indicated. That is perhaps a standing issue, which I believe it is. And I'm not saying the result there was wrong, but there is absolutely nothing in Freeman and Emergency One, which the Court of Appeals relied upon, which states that there has to be disproportionate harm or that a nationwide price conspiracy affecting citizens in every state is not actionable under the Wisconsin Antitrust Act. With respect to being able to allege the particulars.
Counsel, yeah. I'm sorry, but your red light.
No.
thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Mr. Wilson, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, you have 5 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, counsel, Eric Wilson on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. There is an important question that the Court has been asked to address today that has nothing to do with patent law. And if the Court accepts Bayer's answer to that question, the reason I'm here today is to inform the Court that it would decimate the state antitrust law enforcement that our office does. In the Olstead case in footnote 14, this Court pointed out the significant law enforcement that our office does under our state's antitrust statute. It cited the Vitamins case, which was an international price-fixing cartel that our office pursued. If Bayer's argument were accepted, we could not have brought that case. The Microsoft case itself is another good example. That was a case involving our office, attorneys general from other states, the U.S. Department of Justice. There was no allegation in that case that Wisconsin residents had been disproportionately affected. Our office played a key role in the litigation in that case in the late 1990s. We could not have brought that case if Bayer's argument were accepted here today. And so I'll try to paraphrase what Mr. Bartlett cited, which was that question on the court's website, which was, can a plaintiff allege an antitrust violation under our state antitrust statute by merely claiming that some product worked its way into Wisconsin? I think the answer to that question for purposes of today's case is that nothing in the antitrust statute and nothing in the Olstead opinion prevents that. To ease the court's concern, though, there are decades and decades of jurisprudence that do sometimes prevent situations like that where plaintiffs get thrown out of court, such as cases dealing with personal jurisdiction, cases dealing with standing. As I think Mr. Bartlett has ably pointed out, the Sulkowski case, I think the concern that motivated the court there was that the harm was somehow too remote. That's not a question under Olstead. That's a standing issue. And that should have been dealt with under the decades and decades of jurisprudence that have developed under the law of antitrust standing. And so there are mechanisms for courts, for trial courts, to weed out those cases that aren't properly brought under the Wisconsin antitrust statute. And so I think it bears noting that the Sulkowski case decided by the Court of Appeals just 2 months ago is just plain wrong. And that's an important...
Has a petition for review been filed? I just didn't check the
Good record. Question.
Okay, I can check that. Go ahead.
I think that's an important statement because, respectfully, it is the only case that supports Bear's argument here. No other case has ever held that you have to have some sort of special effect in Wisconsin to properly allege a claim under Wisconsin's antitrust statute.
Well, until the Olstead case, we were talking about intrastate commerce.
Justice Prosser, in the Olstead case, in fact, could not have been brought under Bear's argument because the Olstead case was actually an offshoot of the litigation that our office brought against Microsoft. And in that case, you had in-state Wisconsin residents claiming that they had paid more for Microsoft products as a result of Microsoft's anti-competitive conduct. There was no allegation that Wisconsin residents were somehow disproportionately affected as compared to Minnesota residents. There was no allegation of specific special harm here in Wisconsin in that case.
Was its Microsoft's conduct in that case limited to Wisconsin?
No.
The anti-competitive.
It was nationwide, and in fact, as a result of the Microsoft enforcement action that our office and other attorneys general brought, there were private class actions filed in each and every state across the country that has enacted an indirect purchaser action like Wisconsin. And so the scenario, Justice Prosser, that you foretold of the U.S. Department of Justice, state attorneys general, private counsel, that actually exists. There is that quilt patchwork antitrust enforcement out there right now today. And I would respectfully suggest that is the enforcement scheme that the courts have envisioned in ruling that state antitrust law is not preempted by federal antitrust law. And so it routinely happens that you have our office cooperating with the U.S. Department of Justice or the Federal Trade Commission, filing the same case against defendants where private class action counsel has brought a case. That is the quilt and the framework that is out there right now.
Counselor, do you have a policy in your office about whether the AG's office routinely intervenes in these antitrust actions? Because I'm looking at the Sulkowski case, and I don't see the state having any participation, but that may not be
right.
In my copy.
We don't have a policy per se. However, frequently our office and other state attorneys general will file suit after private attorneys have filed an action. So you will see sometimes sort of tag-along actions filed by state attorneys general when private attorneys have filed suit.
Did you file a non-party brief in the Sulkowski case?
No, we did not, Your Honor. We did not know about that case until after the Court of Appeals decision.
Justice Prosser had a question, I think.
I didn't quite hear Justice Rogensack's question. Did you say... Is the state involved, or is the state going to file a case against Bayer?
No. We are not involved in this case in any way, Your Honor. The only way...
Does the state buy Cipro?
Oh, I'm sure state Medicaid has paid lots of money to the defendants.
Okay. But you're not part of the class in this case. Is that
right? We are not a part of the class. We are not a party to this, the
Why
case before the court.
Why didn't the Department of Justice file suit?
Respectfully, Your Honor, that would require me to comment on investigations in our office. I mean, I am aware of this case. Our office has looked at this case, okay? And
you may be filing, or you may not be filing.
Whether and how and why we exercise our prosecutorial discretion in this particular matter is not something that...
So, in your view, did Bayer violate 13303?
I will tell you this, Justice Prosser. The fact scenario in this case is a fact scenario that one sees time and time and time again, which is a prescription drug company with a patent. The patent's about to expire, and they negotiate an agreement with a company that's about to enter into the market with a generic. And that agreement is sort of deemed by plaintiffs as sort of a payoff, so to speak. And I'm not suggesting that's what happened here. But that sort of fact pattern is something that's played out time and time and time again. It's not unique to this case. And there have been numerous cases that have held those sorts of agreements to be violations, to be anti-competitive. There have also been cases going the other way.
Counselor, but those agreements you're talking about would affect a term of time after the patent expired, correct?
The agreements that have been held to be illegal are where the generic entrant agrees to stay out of the market for a particular period of time.
Right, but my question to you is that the only ones that I have found, and you know a lot more about it than I do, that's for sure, were ones that the patent was expiring and they would have essentially continued the dominance by the patent holder after the expiration of the patent.
I think that's basically correct, Your Honor. The allegation is that the patent holder, there was a period of time after which the patent expired where the patent holder could not have exercised market dominance but for this illegal agreement.
Right, right. Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
But here are the only, just so I'm correct, the patent expired in 2004, and did this go beyond 2004?
Plaintiff's counsel is probably better prepared than me to answer that question.
Well, I thought, maybe just so, I thought that this was a period of time before 2004 when Bayer was entering the market while, I'm talking Bayer was entering the market while Bayer had this patent before 2004.
And
maybe, okay.
Do you have a question?
What I thought. And I thought I stand to be corrected, that's what I was hoping you would.
I do not stand here to correct you.
Okay.
All right. Respectfully, I would urge that the court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals.
If I may.
Go ahead.
If the Department of Justice thinks that this complaint is valid, under 13303, aren't you in effect saying that Bayer and Barr violated a criminal statute?
Violated a what statute?
Criminal statute.
It is true. The antitrust law is unique in this regard. I think securities law is probably the only other example where you can find that the exact same elements that a plaintiff needs to prove for a civil violation are the elements that you need to prove for a criminal violation. There is an extraordinary amount of discretion given to prosecutors to decide which cases are the ones that are appropriate for criminal law enforcement. So, yes, any civil violation, there is no more you need to prove a criminal violation. But obviously, there are hosts and hosts of civil antitrust cases that don't end up in criminal court. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson. Mr. Bartlett, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
In response to Justice Wilcox's question, this was not a patent that was about to expire. The settlement was in 1997 early. The patent expired in 2003, so it was not like that genre of cases. In response to...
the agreement extend beyond 2003?
There's no more patent. The patent is gone now.
No, did the agreement extend beyond 2003?
No, it did not,
okay,
as, Justice, as Judge Traeger found. In response to the Chief Justice's question, Zukowski case was not appealed to this court, and the time to the deadline to appeal is passed. In response to the Chief Justice's question about maybe we did the wrong thing and we should have moved to dismiss, the fact is we did move to dismiss in the trial court on the grounds that we have a valid patent. The trial judge then, having the Conley case extant, didn't have to reach that question and simply said there's no interstate commerce here. It goes to interstate commerce. It's not just intrastate. And then along came this court's decision, Microsoft, which struck that sentence from Conley. So that's how we ended up in this. But we did move, of course. And, you know, it's interesting, Justice Rogensack, I've been immersed in this for 10 years, and sometimes you don't see the forest for the trees. Your comment that, you know, fresh eyes are good, I guess that's why we have courts like this. Your Honor said, don't they have to show for the substantial effect that they could have marketed in Wisconsin? I wrote that down. To show they could have marketed in Wisconsin, they have to show there's no valid patent, because if we have a valid patent, they could not have marketed in Wisconsin. And really, we wrote a lot of briefs that could have been short enough if we'd stated that to begin with, I hate to say. Justice Butler, you said this entire thing wasn't presented originally in January 1997 to the settlement judge. Should that have an impact? It was presented to six other federal judges after that, all of whom said that what we did was right. The three federal circuit judges and three federal trial judges. So this case has been thoroughly ventilated. And with regard to paragraphs 57 and 58 of the complaint, that peculiar allegation that without the stipulation we'd be entitled to sell, is that a backhanded allegation of an invalidity issue which no Wisconsin court could consider? It really isn't, because the next paragraph, 58, says if Barr prevails in court, they would sell everywhere. They didn't prevail in court. The patent's valid, so they never had a right to sell anywhere. They never had a right to sell in Wisconsin, so how could all of the events that have took place here possibly have had a substantial effect on the citizens of Wisconsin? Thank you extremely much for all the good questions, which helped us a lot.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank all the counsel, Mr. Bartlett, Mr. Armstrong, Mr. Wilson, for their arguments today in a very interesting motion to dismiss case. That will conclude our hearing in 03 AP 2840, Mayors versus Beyer, and the court will take a few minutes recess so that these students may leave and other students may enter the courtroom.